This edition of Monocle on Saturday was first broadcast on the 20th of January, 2024. I'm Georgina Godwin, broadcasting to you live from Midori House in London. This is Monocle on Saturday. Coming up on today's programme, we'll have a look through the week's news and culture with the Austrian journalist and author Tessa Siskowitz. Then...
There's probably now nowhere in the world where people feel so equally at home. Mandarin is commonly spoken, English is commonly spoken, and I think that that position as neutral territory makes it a key meeting point for a very diverse array of audiences.
Monocle's Lillian Fawcett visits Singapore's International Art Fair, ArtSG, and finds out how Singapore is trying to establish itself as a global art hub. First, though, here's the news. Tensions are rising among the Israeli cabinet, with reports that the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Defence Minister Yoav Gallant are barely on speaking terms. A key member of Israel's war cabinet, Gadi Eisenkot, has accused Netanyahu of not telling the truth about military goals in Gaza, calling for fresh elections, saying there's no trust in Israel's current leadership. The United States and Japan are looking to make a deal for Japanese shipyards to regularly overhaul and maintain US Navy warships so they can stay in Asian waters ready for any potential conflict. That's according to the US ambassador to Japan, Rahm Emanuel. Unchallenged in Asian waters for decades, the US Navy faces a growing Chinese Navy being built in shipyards that are outpacing US warship production. And more than 10,000 New Zealand Maori congregated in the central North Island today to discuss how to respond to government plans that are seen by many Indigenous groups as undermining their rights and status. The centre-right coalition, which took office in October, is planning to undo policies of previous governments, particularly those promoting the official use of the Maori language and those enhancing Indigenous living standards and rights. And that's your Monocle Radio News. Hello and welcome to Monocle on Saturday. Welcome to my guest, who is Tessa Siskowitz. Tess, thank you very much for coming in. We've just discovered we live quite near each other.
That's true, and good morning to you.
And you have been spending these winter days swimming in our common heath in the ponds.
Yes, you know, it's almost a mass movement now, this little crazy idea of middle-aged women jumping into cold water in the middle of the winter. But it makes you happy. And it's, by the way, not only women, but at the ladies' pond, clearly only women allowed. And yeah, the men's pond, if you want to pick it up now as a man and you're listening to us, there is a men's pond and there's even a mixed pond.
There's a mixed pond too, yeah, which is great. I am going to be swimming next week. You wouldn't catch me swimming in Hampstead Heath in this weather. Next week, I'm going to be in the Caribbean.
Oh my God, so this is the real thing, of course. Oh, you lucky one.
I'm going off to Cartagena for Hey Cartagena, which is, yes, a literary festival. And so if you happen to be in the region, do join us. Some fantastic talks going on, really great sessions with some amazing writers. And I just feel so privileged to be in conversation with many of them in this fantastic location. I don't know if you've been there, but it's this great ancient walled town right on the Caribbean, and it's just beautiful.
I unfortunately haven't been there, but people are raving about it. And the idea to put a hay festival there, of course, is an absolute genius idea to bring everyone together.
Yeah. Hay is very good at that. They do this thing where they won't go generally for the capital of somewhere. They'll go somewhere that's a little bit out and just a little bit different. And yeah, and also just it brings sort of culture and so much richness, economic as well as intellectual, into sometimes neglected regions, which is, I think, a great service.
I hope you don't call the original Hay a neglected region.
What? Well,
careful now.
Wales not had a lot of attention paid to it.
It's very beautiful, though.
It's very beautiful.
It's always very nice.
Let's have a look at the papers. And let's start in your, I was going to say your native Germany. It's not. You're Austrian.
It is my native Germany. I just grew up in Austria. And then that's why my accent is slightly soft German, Austrian, English that I speak, so you can hear where I'm from.
Okay. I wouldn't have pegged that one, but anyway, thank you. But the German Defence Minister, Boris Pistorius, has been talking. Very influential, this. Tell us more.
Boris Pistorius is an interesting character because it also is a sign that the Bundeskanzler, the head of state, not the head of state, the Prime Minister of Germany, Olaf Scholz, is a little bit in trouble for being too careful in his trying to maneuver with his complicated coalition of Green Liberals and Social Democrats. And Boris Pistorius, as a defense minister, has found a way to reach people recently and has been rising in the polls also as a possible replacement of Olaf Scholz. And what he says now, you know, German defense has been, you know, famously not being a very sort of strong military statement since 1945, which I always thought was a good thing. But recently, of course, our world has changed. And with the Ukraine war, it becomes clear that there is a possible real threat also to Germany coming from Putin in the next 5 years, as Boris Pistorius said yesterday in an interview with Tagesspiegel in Berlin, which is a daily in Berlin. And it was picked up by Politico immediately, our new sort of global or pan-European medium, Politico. And so they were discussing with him if the term kriegstüchtig or wehrhaft, which means ready for war, is the new thing for Germany. So Pistorius says we have to really build up the army and even rethink the question if we should have a compulsory military service back in Germany, which was dismantled a few years back. And so now the question is if we don't need, you know, to be able to pull in reservists from the population after their compulsory military service, if it is reinstated, because we might see a situation like in the Ukraine where you just need a constant supply of young men going into the army to defend the country. So it's a very, very big shift for German thinking, because we thought the wars were over, as did everyone in Europe, I think, for these direct threat on the territory of European Union countries. Mm.
And I mean, of course, what he says, he's not alone in this. We've had on Wednesday the chair of NATO's military committee of national chiefs, that's Admiral Rob Bauer. He also said that it's the most dangerous world in decades. We've had the Swedish commander-in-chief saying that Swedes must prepare themselves mentally for war. I mean, this is a pretty much being echoed around the world. There is one question, though, I wonder about, which is at the last World War, people were kind of happy to step, not happy, but did step up for their country. It's all the old, you know, dulce et decorum est pro patria mori. But now, these days, people are not prepared to die for their country. That unswerving and unthinking, almost, loyalty, the new generation, I don't think share in that mindset at all, which is, I'm sure, a good thing, but
I really think it's a good thing. So we are not talking about a kind of new nationalist, war-hungry continent where the nations go against each other and everything that happened in the Second World War, I think, has left especially the countries who were the battlefields and who were perpetrators and victims really scarred. Mm. So it's not that Germany wants to fight a war now just to gain territory or whatever happened, you know, in the history. But what it's really about is, and that's the way how it's perceived, I think, in most capitals now, is to defend democracy against autocracy, to defend sort of peaceful European Union states from an aggression coming from a crazy dictator in Russia who might not stop with the Ukraine. I mean, all this, of course, is not that people expect a war in Berlin tomorrow. I mean, let's really not go overboard now with this threat to the center of Europe. But we see that the aggressiveness in the Ukraine and the need for Putin to keep his regime going, to threaten more outside conflict and to be perceived as the defender of the Russian nation against an, in his views, aggressive West, might just escalate more over the years. So it's quite good to be prepared. And I've been, since I was EU correspondent 30 years ago, I've been always thinking about the need to pool European armies together in a kind of reasonable, functional, not necessarily army, but so that you can have a central command if you need troops to be sent somewhere.
Which is, of course, what Macron wants.
Yes, and I think the French are quite good because the French have a considerable army also, so they can speak to it and they were ready to use them also. And Germany was always very reluctant. And this has changed now. And I think smaller countries who are directly more threatened by the vicinity to Russia, like the Scandinavian countries. You know, it was unthinkable for a neutral country like Sweden to join NATO 5 years ago, and now we are there. So I think we have to watch this shift closely because it might be also almost a unifying factor for the European Union states, in that case, even including the UK, to think how to defend, in general terms, democracy against non-democratic forces.
Yeah, of course, Russia is not the only aggressor. Iran, increasingly, who, of course, has all these proxies that they back, but very much in the news this week because of the attacks on Pakistan. And in fact, I know that you actually wrote an editorial about it in your weekly Falter. Tell us your take on this.
Well, it's always quite interesting that Iran, if you follow the American Israeli line, is seen to be the evil factor in this power game in the Middle East. And there is a lot of truth in that. But the interesting thing is that Iran, while it has always financed these proxy armies, and you have seen this now, of course, with Hamas striking with weapons they got from Iran, Hezbollah, who is sitting on a huge arsenal of arms that they got with the help of Iran, and now the Houthis in Yemen using this solidarity wave for the Palestinians to also sort of instigate trouble in the region. And all this, of course, is directed more on America than it is on anyone else. And the only thing that happened this week, which was really surprising, is that Iran, who had always stepped, you know, financed proxy armies, but doesn't usually get directly involved anymore in regional conflict, has started to bomb Syria, Iraq and Pakistan in the last 10 days. And that's quite an interesting movement, which the New York Times has a very good explainer on this also this week, which has to do, of course, with the internal politics that Iran has a lot of stress coming from their radical wings, so that they needed to show that they can actually strike back against the attacks that happened against Iran in Iran in the last days. So let's hope that this is only tit for tat little battle fighting, because a lot of innocent people get drawn into this whole fight between Iran and Pakistan over border regions where on both sides the same people live and they have no interest really
although
in a real war.
That's been de-escalated now. Iran and Pakistan have worked it out.
Well, that's the hope, that these are also punctual things always, which don't really pull the whole region into a full-out war, because that's what we really don't need.
But I mean, everybody is making the point here that Iran really has no stomach, apart from what we've just seen, but no stomach for a direct fight.
Well, I think we also, nobody has that. You know, can you imagine a full war that Iran would get involved in if Hezbollah unleashes all its weapons on the north of Israel? There will be a lot of weapons coming back on the south of Lebanon on Hezbollah, not only hitting Hezbollah positions. So I think nobody really wants that. And a lot of escalating factors could take us there. So I really do hope that it doesn't happen.
Now let's go to Haaretz, which is, of course, an Israeli newspaper, but it's actually commenting on one of America's leading intellectuals and what she has written about the conflict. Tell us more about Masha Gessen.
I mean, this is a scandal that has rocked Germany again. Although Marsha Gessen is one of these Russian-American intellectuals that I have followed since I was posted in Moscow. She has, you know, demonstrated alone with her bicycle against Putin at the beginning of the 2000s. And because she felt that she had to leave Russia earlier than others because she's gay, and it wasn't very pleasant for her to be under Putin's laws against gay people. And so she left relatively early, went back to the States. She has sort of a dual nationality. And when she developed her criticism on this basis of fighting for human rights in Russia. And when she saw now how the whole debate goes in Europe and in America on how to take a position in the war that Israel is fighting against Hamas in Gaza, she felt that it's too limited in terms of taking a position also in solidarity with the children and women and men, civilians dying in Gaza. And I think her essay that she wrote in the New Yorker in the shadow of the Holocaust at the beginning of December carries this sentiment, which I thought was actually a very good essay. What she did, which got her in trouble in Germany, is that she compared the Gaza Strip with Jewish ghettos in Nazi-occupied Europe. And that's a kind of no-no in the German debate. And I can feel that too in myself, that I don't like Nazi comparisons because they have been used sort of inflationary for everything. And it often doesn't really hit the point. So I myself, in my writing, I'm always very careful. But what she did is quite, you know, she felt that she needed to push a little bit against the status quo of the debate in Germany, where everyone is very sort of careful not to criticize the Israeli government. And if we do criticize the Israeli government, it's very limited in the sense that you have the feeling it leaves out the empathy for the civilians in Gaza. So her point of this comparison of the Jewish ghettos in Nazi-occupied Europe with the Gaza Strip is connected with a very complicated case of the working definition for anti-Semitism that was established by the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance. So the IHRA definition says that drawing comparisons of contemporary Israeli policy to that of the Nazis is considered to be anti-Semitic. And she says that cannot be. This is limiting our intellectual debate, our historic exploration. You can make comparisons and they might be not right, but you shouldn't be punished for it. And they are definitely not, they shouldn't be seen definitely as anti-Semitic. And so she got into a lot of trouble because she was supposed to get the Hannah Arendt Prize supported by the Heinrich Böll Foundation, which is the Green Party's foundation. And they sort of took back their support for her at that point. And she got the prize, but in a very smaller framework. And people have sort of started to disinvite her in Germany, which I think is really a shame, because I think she's a very, very sincere thinker and also fighter for human rights. And I think we should all be able to hold these two positions in front of us, that we say we are very much for the right to exist for Israel, but we also see that the Palestinians need the support of the international community because they have nowhere to go at the moment in this war that is relentlessly bombing their houses.
Of course, there's another woman who's stirring up debate on that too, which is Ursula von der Leyen, who's kind of gone against the EU consensus to speak out about the war. All hail Queen Ursula is one of the headlines we've seen this week. Tell us more.
Well, the background, of course, is clear. So Ursula von der Leyen, who was the defense minister of Germany before she became the president of the EU Commission for this term, she is a German conservative. She's sitting very much in the tradition of Angela Merkel. So her German identity led her to very quickly go to Israel to show also solidarity with Israel, which then again put her in trouble because she hadn't sort of got a sort of consensus among all the commissioners and also among the capitals of Europe. And there are some, like the Spanish or the Italians, that might be a bit more critical towards the Israeli government than the German government generally is. So she just got the whole European spectacle of how to deal with Israel and Palestine on her shoulders. But she has recovered from this criticism and is now back in the news because the big question is when she will declare. Not so much if, but when she will declare that she's running for a second term as Commission President. You know, we have these European elections coming up in June 6th to 9th, and the Parliament will be elected. Everyone fears a little bit a far-right surge of the parties, especially in Italy or, for example, also in Austria and Germany, where the AfD has become quite strong. And Ursula von der Leyen is sort of the antithesis to this right-wing surge because she has actually done quite a good job, in my view at least, being supposedly sleeping even in her office and working long hours and getting a very strict agenda through the commission in the last years, which were ripped by huge crises like COVID pandemic. And now, of course, the war in the Ukraine and a lot of different positions in the European capitals on all of these topics. And so she has already indicated now this week that she wants to keep the direction of travel for the big topics in her current mandate, which sort of means that she's more or less planning to come out with declaring her candidacy to become Commission President again. Her big topics, you know, that she got through, it's quite interesting because it's a little bit similar like Joe Biden in Washington, you know, focusing on the Green Deal, on the digital transitions, on resilience in crisis, in sort of bringing together financial aid in a big way for help in pandemic struck countries, but also to get help through for defending the Ukrainian state against Russian aggression. I mean, that was not a given that that would be possible in the European Union. And she did that. And so I think she is basically a shoo-in also if she declares. She will get the support of most of the capitals. But of course, you never know.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to now have a little bit of German humour, and I'm not going to make the obvious comment that that's an oxymoron.
You can, you can. It's Saturday morning. We can take it, we can take it.
Tell us about this piece in Der Spiegel.
So what happened, as I said before, we have a big surge of far-right support in Germany currently. The alternative for Deutschland is quite popular. So that's not the part where the sense of humor comes in. This is the sad reality. But what is happening now over the weekend is that the so-called silent majority is marching on the streets to say, like, Germany is not a far-right country with Nazi sympathies. Because there was a big conference recently in Germany held where the far-right was discussing remigration of millions of people and also of Germans that they don't like for political reasons. So it was quite a threatening thing that came from this corner of the far-right quite loudly. And so now people are now marching against it. And tens of thousands of people have been yesterday in Hamburg on the streets, and it will be going on throughout the whole weekend. People are saying that they are against non-democratic and anti-foreigner rhetoric and all this. And now Spiegel has yesterday published the new song of a rock band called Catcar. The song is called München, and it has lyrics to the likes of Wo ich geboren bin, alte Lady, mein Herz ist ein totgeschlagenes Robbenbaby. Robbenbaby is a small animal. And it's sort of, it's funny, but it's also clear that it talks about how you grow up in Germany when you are not German, but sort of with a migrant background, and how difficult it is to get people to understand that you don't, you shouldn't ask people who look as if they haven't been born in Germany necessarily where they are really from. You know, this from Prince Charles, sort of now King Charles here in Britain too. But so this song was published yesterday on the Spiegel website, and I thought it's actually quite a it has quite a nice tune, so I thought we should maybe have a listen.
Let's do that.
Da sind Jachi und ich auf dem Mannschaftsfoto der ersten B-Jugend bei der TSV. Wir sind zusammen auf das Heinrich-Heine gegangen, haben unten am Spielplatz heimlich geraucht. Er kam zum Essen und meine Mutter fragte, darf ich einmal dein schönes schwarzes Haar anfassen? Du hast sie gelassen, etwas verkrampft, gelächelt, gegessen und ich fühl mich bedankt.
It's not the most melodious.
No, but it's a sort of a rock band, yeah. So they and he's telling the story how his friend came to dinner in when they were children after playing football, and his mother was saying like, "Can I touch your beautiful slick black hair?" And the boy sort of thought like, "Mm-hmm, it's really really awkward and uncomfortable." She probably didn't mean that as a sort of she didn't want to insult him, but he felt that he was treated as a sort of special item on the dinner table of a German family at the time. And I think it shows that in Germany has really started to understand now that it's an immigration country, that you don't treat people what happened to all these Turkish and other so-called guest workers from the 70s on, that they were never really integrated in a welcoming way into the society or treated as people who should just also have a German existence and be German. And now you have a generation that grew up at this time and has become German as everyone else. And they are taking the self-confidence now also not only into boardrooms, but also to the streets. And I think it's a very good thing. And this weekend is actually, that's the only positive thing we can say about this dreadful world of politics at the moment, that there are also counter movements. So you have not only far right people marching, but you have also the silent majority saying, like, we want to defend our values, and the values are democracy and inclusivity and pluralism in a society.
And diversity too is coming to the art world in Singapore. Art SG, Southeast Asia's largest art fair, has returned to Singapore's Marina Bay Sands this weekend for its second edition. 114 galleries will feature at the event, which launched last year after delays due to COVID. It's been seen as Singapore's latest attempt to establish itself as a global art hub. But the city-state faces stiff competition in Hong Kong, which is more firmly established as the region's arts powerhouse. Well, on the fair's opening day, Monocle's Lillian Fawcett caught up with Magnus Renfrew, who established Art SG after co-founding some of Hong Kong's leading art fairs. Lillian asked what Magnus learnt from last year.
Well, I think it always takes a bit of time to build a fair and for it to bed in. But I think that year on year, we've seen a marked increase in the level of activity within the city. The city has really embraced the fair this year. In the first year, I think that you're putting out a marker there for people to really see what it is that you're trying to achieve. And word of mouth marketing is really important in terms of second year success. And so I think the collectors came last year and talked very positively about their experience of being in town and the sort of the richness and the diversity of the offerings and the strength of the fair. And so we've witnessed an uptick in international attendance of collectors from Australia, from China, from Korea, from Taiwan. Partially as a result of really increased activity on our part in terms of outreach. We really started a VIP roadshow in September in Sydney, moving on to Jakarta, Manila, Bangkok, Kuala Lumpur, Shanghai, and of course Singapore itself. And that seems to have really paid dividends.
And you've been involved in founding art fairs, you know, across Asia, some of the best known art fairs really in the region. Why did you decide now, or well, last year was kind of the right time to start an international art fair in Singapore?
Southeast Asia has a population of 650 million people. It's approaching Europe in scale. So logic dictates that it deserves one decent international art fair. And it's home to many of the fastest growing economies in the world. And historically, we've really seen the potential for this fair to be a hub fair, in the sense that historically Singapore has not had a collector base that's big enough to sustain an art fair of this scale. And so it's very much about bringing in the different collector bases from each of the constituencies around the region. And historically, Indonesia and the Philippines have been two of the major collector bases in the region, but also Thailand is now very important. And we see the natural catchment area for the fair as being Southeast Asia, a bit of Australia, a bit of India, how we can bring those communities together in Singapore to connect them with each other, but also to connect them with the rest of Asia and from collectors and the art community from further afield as well. But having said all that, the case for Singapore has really greatly strengthened over the last few years and over the time of the pandemic. And I don't feel that people have fully recognised quite how much things have changed as of yet. The terminology over the last few years has been shifting from Asia-Pacific to Indo-Pacific. And whereas Singapore couldn't really lay claim to be the capital of the Asia-Pacific, it's the de facto and recognized hub of the Indo-Pacific, and always has been, partially because of its historical role as a key stop-off on the maritime Silk Road between India and China. And in addition to that, the city has incredibly broad business offerings. One of the key attributes now, I think, for Singapore is its position as being truly neutral territory within Asia. And there's probably now nowhere in the world where people feel so equally at home. Mandarin is commonly spoken, English is commonly spoken. And I think that that position as neutral territory makes it a key place for being a meeting point for a very diverse array of audiences.
That brings me quite seamlessly onto another question which I was going to ask you. And obviously you've worked a lot in Hong Kong, and that's a place that's seen massive upheavals in the last few years, you know, political changes and COVID. So what's your kind of assessment of how those big changes have affected the art scene in Hong Kong?
I think it's a bit too early to tell whether or not the political situation has had any impact on Hong Kong's status as a commercial hub. Certainly the auction houses have been doubling down on their investments there through having long-term leases and so on, and moving into new buildings. And the auction market has continued to do well there, and galleries have been opening up and moving into new locations and so on. But whether or not the political situation is going to impact the kind of the psychological catchment area for Hong Kong, I think it's too early to tell. But it's a city for which I have great affection and spend a lot of time and energy in helping to develop the art scene there. So I'm hoping that it's going to go from strength to strength.
And just finally, looking to the future, I'm sure you're hoping this will be two of many editions of Art SG. Are there any particular countries or regions that you are hoping to feature more in Art SG in the future, and where are you kind of planning its evolution?
Well, as the fair develops and as the context of Singapore and Southeast Asia develops, I think that we're going to see increased interest from around the world, and we're looking forward to building on solid foundations over the coming years to attract high caliber galleries from around the world, not just from Europe and America, but also from the rest of Asia and of course from Southeast Asia. We're very much hoping that the fair in Singapore can help to stimulate the market within Southeast Asia, to help to encourage perhaps new galleries to start opening up in different parts of Southeast Asia. So we really want to be a part of the process to help to expand not only the awareness of what's happening here, but also to really perhaps help to play a role in developing the infrastructure that can help to sustain an ecosystem within Southeast Asia for the long term.
Many thanks there to Lillian in Singapore. And that's all for Monocle on Saturday. Thanks to our producer and studio engineer, Mariella Bevan. My guest was Tess Siskovitz. Monocle on Saturday returns next weekend. Eben Nelson will be in the seat for that one, but I'll be back with you for Monocle on Sunday tomorrow. Thanks for listening.